I don't know if you're aware, but the great film Gladiator turns 20 this year. I turned 30 this year, and I remember Gladiator, which had a 15 age certificate at the time, and I'd heard of it, and I really wanted to see it. My older brother had seen it and took great glee in telling me all about it, but I had to wait until it came out on VHS, which is like a DVD, but older. And I watched it, and I have to say, when I watched it, I was immediately struck by it. I love it. And to this day, I would argue that in spite of its age, it remains one of the greatest films of all time. It's an action-packed classic featuring Maximus, the general of Rome, who becomes a slave and ultimately dies defending honour and values in the Colosseum, having defeated evil. There's so many themes and so many potential sermon openers contained within one film, and that surely cements its history as a true cinematic classic. And early on in the film, Maximus, this general, he's single-handedly won a battle, and he's having an open and candid conversation with Caesar, the ruler of the entire Roman Empire, as you do. And Caesar, sort of at this point in the film, senses he's dying, and he turns to Maximus and he asks Maximus, "Let's talk." And in an almost Shakespearean-like soliloquy, Marcus Aurelius, the Caesar, pours out his soul to Maximus, showing in his final moments what it was that occupies his thoughts as he senses he's dying. And he says, "Maximus, when a man sees his end, he wants to know there was some purpose to his life. How will the world speak my name in years to come? Will I be remembered as the philosopher, the warrior, the tyrant, or will I be the emperor who gave Rome back her true self?" See, Ridley Scott, the director, depicts brilliantly the vulnerability of a man who, despite having ruled most of the known universe at this time, in his final moments is wondering and agonising over his impending death and how he would be remembered. In effect, he wanted to know if he'd be immortalised and how his legacy would live on. And see, legacy and concerns of how one's memory will live on is not the reserve of ailing Roman emperors in roughly 180 AD. Nowadays, sports stars, celebrities and musicians have taken to appointing legacy managers in life to ensure that even after their death, they are immortalised with greatest hits albums, social media posts and even fragrances. We're all going to be treated, and I truly mean that, by a Justin Bieber greatest hits compilation 5 years after his death. And he stipulated that the story of his life must be portrayed through the medium of film prior to being made into a West End hit. In today's passage, we read of two apostles who were similarly deeply concerned with ideas of greatness. Unlike Marcus Aurelius, they were aware that they were to spend eternity with God, but even still, they sought glory and recognition, seeking to elevate themselves above others. Turn with me, if you will, to Mark chapter 10, starting the reading today at verse 35. It's titled "The Request of James and John." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places alone belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Then Jesus came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside, begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. This passage that we've just read immediately follows the third prediction of Jesus' death that Jesus makes in verses 32 through to 34. Following on from his baptism, Jesus knew that this was his calling, his mission, his destiny, if you will, and talking and preaching on his death becomes the mainstay of his ministry at this point. See, it was imperative that the disciples understood and appreciated that the prophecies in Isaiah are about to be fulfilled. And so, having preached and shared about his death in the most graphic account to date, in verses 32 to 34, we read words such as, "He will be handed over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him and kill him. And 3 days later he will rise." Jesus has, effect in these verses, poured himself out to his followers. He's shared and warned of what is to come. Jerusalem is looming large on the horizon, if you will. And it's into this narrative that we see two reactions to what Jesus has taught on, exposed and laid bare. I want to take this morning to focus on two different requests of Jesus that this passage gives us. Two points in the sermon. Consequentially, if I get the 2 points, it'll be 2 points more than I've ever scored in Peebles. I played rugby for a while, and it was always a very torrid afternoon when we came to Peebles. Firstly, we're going to look at the request of James and John. And secondly, we're going to look at the request of blind Bartimaeus at the roadside. James and John are known and often referred to as the sons of thunder. They're two of the disciples that Jesus was closest to. It's clear to know why they were called the sons of thunder after this passage. Having just laid himself bare, been very vulnerable, been very open and honest, James and John steam right in and ask Jesus if they can sit at his right and left hand when he comes in glory. It's a revealing request at best. At worst, it's something else. It shows us the heart of James and John. However, I would argue it also shows us more of the heart of Jesus. We see in this request James and John's failure to understand what it is that Jesus is on earth to do. In 32 to 34, Jesus said exactly what it is that is to happen to him. And James and John still just don't seem to get it. We know that James and John are close to Jesus and that they come from a background where their father had hired hands. They were obviously Jews, and so we see this most middle-class Jewish request to be glorified at the right and left hand of Jesus when he comes in glory. Despite all that has been said, despite their background, their upbringing, it's safe to assume they were educated. They still don't get it. They have this image of Jesus sat on a throne, having come in glory, kicked out the Roman occupying force, and set up shop as ruler of Israel. And not satisfied with that alone, James and John want to be senior figures in his cabinet once he's in power. The ancient days, Boris Johnson, if you like. And how does Jesus respond? Jesus responds with talks of cups and baptism. James and John imagine chariots, castles and thrones, and Jesus responds with suffering and immersion. The cup is often referred to as a metaphor for suffering. Jesus' words in Gethsemane, "Father, if it be your will, take this cup. Father, if it be your will, take this suffering." And the word baptism, the term baptism, originates from the Greek word baptismenos, which means to be submerged, immersed in something. I googled that. As I say, I'm not studying. Many of the people who come and visit you will be students at ETS, and they like to talk about their Greek lessons and their Greek exams, and I often hear so much about it, but I'm able to Google just as good as anyone. So I've not seen the need to take up such study. See, Jesus takes this request of James and John for fame and glory and contrasts it against the reality of the crucifixion and the alienation from God he is to suffer. He contrasts their idea against what is becoming an ever more prevalent reality for him as they approach Jerusalem. But note what's missing here. Jesus doesn't chastise James and John. He corrects them lovingly. He doesn't rebuke them, for truly, in time, James and John are to show that they are willing and able to suffer for Christ. James is eventually beheaded, and John also suffers much for Christ. See, Jesus does not rebuke them, but merely points out that the standard of greatness in the kingdom of God is not measured in thrones, in seats, in crowns, but in the cross. The request of James and John is wrong on so many levels. Morally, James and John are trying to exploit their closeness with Jesus for their own personal gain. They have let their pride and desire for greatness overtake them. Interestingly, this story is also written about in Matthew's Gospel. However, the request in Matthew's Gospel is attributed to James and John's mother. Clearly, Matthew, who is writing his Gospel primarily for a Jewish audience, doesn't believe that such a request is becoming of two Jewish stalwarts, two apostles, and he attributes this request to their mother. But Mark's Gospel, which is written for a more Gentile-orientated audience, he just lands this request square at the feet of James and John. Doesn't pull any punches. Spiritually, James and John have missed the point. They are here hearing Jesus speaking about coming in glory, and they're giddy and excited. Here comes a leader who's going to kick out the Romans. But what's their main interest? What's in this for me? Let's focus on Jesus' response, though. Jesus models good leadership to them. He models humility to them and contrasts their pride with his humility. How easy would it have been for Jesus to say, "You want to be at my left? You want to be at my right when I come in glory? No problem. I'm coming in glory in 2 weeks' time. And you can be there on a cross, on my left and my right at Golgotha, if you so desire." How easy could Jesus tear them down? Jesus knows what is coming. Jesus knows what James and John are going to do. Jesus knows, ultimately, that when his kingdom comes, James and John will be nowhere to be seen, for they will have scattered. They'll not be seen for dust. As we read in Matthew's Gospel, God will strike the shepherd and the sheep will scatter. Jesus knows this, knows all of this, but he doesn't say any of this. We simply read of him modelling humility and showing humble obedience to God when we read Jesus saying, "To sit at my left and my right is not for me to grant." Verse 40. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. Jesus effectively says, that is not my decision, that's for God. I take great comfort in Jesus' response, if I'm honest. A large part of my testimony is about overcoming pride. See, when I was younger, I was of the opinion that I could manage just about fine on my own, do things my way. I was proud. I knew the things of God. I could give all the Sunday school answers. And if I'm honest, I'd probably resolve that that was absolutely fine. Jesus could have my heart. That was no problem. Anyone could have my heart. But my career, my social life, my relationships, they were for me. Thankfully, in my early 20s, there was a huge transformation when I realised that Christ required it all. And he took my pride and my desires and realigned them with his own. See, Jesus calls out pride here and shows what true greatness is. When we read, "Whoever wants to be great amongst you must become your servant." How does that contrast with society nowadays? I don't see much humility on Twitter. I don't see much humility on Instagram. But Jesus calls us to humility, to seek and serve those who are lost and to model ourselves on him. Jesus did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. I want to challenge you this morning. How would looking to serve fit in your life? Are there areas of your life where you've been living for number one, promoting number one, allowing pride to be your driver, allowing pride to be my driver? See, pride is one of the greatest tools the devil uses to prevent us from walking in the path that God would have for us. And anyone who thinks that the church or a Christian is immune from that is naive. Ego, pride and status have caused more fallouts and constrained more ministries than we could even imagine. With churches that even interpret or misinterpret the gospel to say that my needs, my wants, that's okay to focus on. The prosperity gospel. People twist the teachings of the Bible to sanctify their pride and their wants. But see, the issue with pride is that pride places us as number one. Pride would say, I want to do this for me. Self-gratification, look at what I've achieved. See, when pride is our number one, it places us as the focus. Me, my dreams, my visions, my desires, my needs, and not God's. Pride says, look at what I have done. But its humility simply says, Christ has done it all. Whoever wants to be great among you must become your servant. But let me be clear here. Jesus is not decrying ambition, far from it, or the desire to achieve. Quite the opposite. Jesus knows that in time, James and John will be crucial to the leadership of his early church. He knows that we will read of their ministry in thousands of years later. And indeed, that's why I believe Jesus spends so much time modelling leadership to them. Because he wants them to achieve. He wants them to be leaders, to lead and succeed humbly with a servant heart for him and not a pride-filled, egotistical appetite as they have and as they display in this passage. See, James and John had it all. They had a ringside seat at the best sermon and the best lessons and sermons that the greatest preacher that ever walked the earth preached and taught. They were at every rally and every lesson, but they still failed to grasp the point. Maybe that's you. Perhaps you've been attending church for a long time. Perhaps even longer than you'd care to imagine. You serve, perhaps even teach, but you haven't truly grasped the truth of the gospel, that there is nothing we can do. There's no position or knowledge level or act of charity that we can achieve or demonstrate that will earn us the freeing love of Christ. See, that is the freeing truth of the gospel, that we can do nothing to earn the love of Christ, for Christ has done it all, and all we can do is humbly accept that gift. See, this passage, when I was given it, naturally I thought that I would preach on verse 32 through to 44, but someone else, not me, decided that I wouldn't, and that they'd split it up 35 through to where we read, including this small section of verses on Bartimaeus, and I didn't naturally think it lended itself. But when I started studying and reading, I see and saw the great contrast that this passage has. In the first half, we read of James and John and the disharmony of the apostles as they jostle for position and posture off against each other. And then Mark includes this collection of verses that could so easily be missed. And we read at the end of this passage about a man who spends his days at the side of the road as life passes him by. The apostles are trying to cement their status, and we read of Bartimaeus who's trying to survive. He's struggling. It's safe to assume he's cast out by society. He's sat at the side of the road. And why are we told his name? Why are we told Bartimaeus? I think we're told his name because it has significance. Many significant stories in the New Testament, we're not told the name of the people. What was the name of the lady at the well? We're not told it. We're told Bartimaeus' name, son of Timaeus, because it's important. Mark would seek to tell us something about Bartimaeus. It was written in a time when who you were really mattered. Timaeus must have been someone worth mentioning. But regardless of who he was born, who he had been born, what standing he had had in society, Bartimaeus is sat at the side of the road. Life has not gone the way people would have thought it probably would have gone for Bartimaeus. His life's been turned upside down, and he's been left sat at the side of the road, ultimately because he's disabled. What else are we told about Bartimaeus? We're told quite simply, he can hear. He's blind, but he can hear. He hears Jesus is coming, and he grasps who Jesus is, and he calls out. See, Bartimaeus doesn't let his circumstance prevent him from seeking for better. He hears Jesus is coming and he calls out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. 8 words. And in those 8 words, Bartimaeus gets the point. Theologically, he's just knocked spots off James and John, two of the closest and most trusted disciples. Jesus, Son of David. Jesus, King. The one who's been promised. The chosen and anointed one. This is the only time in Mark's Gospel that Jesus is referred to as this. And this is significant. Bartimaeus gets it. That's what we're being shown here. Bartimaeus gets it. He understands the Old Testament prophecies and knows Jesus is the one who's been promised. And what does he say? Jesus, can I be elevated? No. Quite simply, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus, you're God's Son who's been promised. You're of royal descent, Son of David, the royal line. Please help me out here. Jesus, have mercy on me. And as Bartimaeus is again displaying his profound knowledge and grasp of who Jesus is, there are those around Jesus who would seek to have this person from the bottom rung of the social ladder be quiet. They tell Bartimaeus to be quiet, but Bartimaeus perseveres. He calls out again. He knows this is his chance, and he calls out expectantly to Jesus. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. There are so many other things that we could take from the story of Bartimaeus. The fact that he persists despite hindrance. There were those around Jesus who are still not grasping what Jesus is about. But Bartimaeus persists. Undeterred, he visibly shows the faith he has, and he calls out all the more loudly to be healed. And Bartimaeus also calls out to God expecting a transformation. He has an expectant faith. He calls out for healing, and he expects to be saved. That's why he doesn't care, ultimately, about the efforts to rebuke him. He knows in his faith that this is his ticket to healing. He calls out and he expects the healing touch of Christ on his life. And Bartimaeus asks for the right thing. We read, Jesus draws near and says, what do you want me to do for you? Where have we heard that before? The exact same phrase, verse 36. What do you want me to do for you? That Jesus says to James and John before they make their toe-curling, cringe-worthy, self-indulgent request for greatness. But Bartimaeus, quite simply, asks for what he knows Christ alone can deliver and asks that he may see again. See, all of these points are in the story of Bartimaeus. And as I was preparing and reading and writing what to say, I felt God drawing me to this question. And no matter how much I thought that I would focus on the commentary classic, expand a few points, of which there are many, about Bartimaeus, a witty story to conclude, and then home, I felt challenged and called to ask this. See, I truly believe that the story of Bartimaeus has been included today because God would seek to say to some of us, me included, what is it that keeps you at the side of the road? What keeps us at the side of the road? See, we all have things that would seek to leave us at the side of the road, watching life go by. What is it for you? What is it for me? It might well not be a physical illness or a disability, But what is it in your life that would leave you at the side of the road? That word that someone's spoken over you that prevents you from stepping into what God would have for you. That anxiety that cripples you from fulfilling your calling. That lack or loss of a life partner. And that lie that would have you believe that you cannot achieve what it is that God has for you. The fear that if you're to call out and seek to achieve what God would have for you, there are those that would tell you to be quiet. What is it? What keeps us at the side of the road? I want to ask you this morning, have you called out? Have you called out to Jesus and asked him to heal you of that thing, that untruth, that hurt, that lie, that fear that would seek to stop you from being what it is you're called to be? See, we have to call out and expect. For if we call out and ask, but we don't believe, then we haven't truly called out. We read that as Jesus draws near to Bartimaeus, Bartimaeus expects to be healed. We read that he casts aside his cloak, possibly, probably, his only worldly possession. We read that he casts aside his cloak, his comfort blanket, what he has sat on, slept on, perhaps what he even expected to die sitting on. For months, if not years, he casts that aside as he expects to be healed. What's your cloak? What's my cloak? What do we sit on? What do we wrap ourselves in? What do we distract ourselves with when that issue surfaces? When God, that thing God would have for you in your life is brought up again, what do we distract ourselves with? What's our cloak? What's our comfort blanket? What stops us doing and addressing that thing that's holding us back? See, Bartimaeus knows Jesus is in the business of healing. He calls out and he expects to be healed. He chucks his cloak to one side, expectantly, knowing that that cloak he has sat on for years, that's not God's best for him. He's sat on that for years as the world has passed him by, but he knows Jesus is in the business of healing. So he casts it aside and approaches Jesus. And what do we read? Quite simply, your faith has set you free. Your faith has set you free. Not your standing in society, not your Jewish pedigree, not the fact you've been a disciple since the beginning, not your standing in society, your legacy planning. No, quite simply, your faith has set you free. See, I think the tale of Bartimaeus would seek to say two things to us this morning. Maybe you've been sat at the side of the road, watching life and the things of Jesus pass you by. And there's been something that's held you back from approaching. I think Jesus would call to you again this morning and ask you to leave that place and come on the journey. Whatever blindness that's been holding you back, I believe Jesus would say, I can handle that. I can heal that. Ask and you shall receive. Secondly, I think there may be some of us here who've been on the road for many years, have hung around church long enough to be dangerous. But there's a blindness that's crept into our Christian life that's preventing us from walking fully into a calling that Jesus would have for us. I think Jesus would say, give me that piece of hurt, that doubt, that insecurity. Cast aside your cloak and walk into what I have for you. See, God is here this morning, as he was on that road passing Bartimaeus, en route to Jerusalem, to bleed and die on a cross. And just as Bartimaeus called out, so too we can call out. Perhaps it may be your first time calling out and saying to God, I've heard the things of you, I've heard them many times, but today I need to stop sitting at the side of the road and get on the road with you. A road at times marked with suffering, but the only road that leads to glory. Or perhaps you've been on the road for many years, and there's been a word spoken or a circumstance that's come up that's seen you take a seat at the side of the road. Whatever it is, whatever thing, whatever circumstance, that would seek to have you sat at the side of the road. Jesus is willing and able to heal and restore you, just as he was with Bartimaeus. I think Jesus would seek to remind some of us of that this morning. I'm Jesus. I'm in the business of restoring and making new. Sight to the blind, confidence to the shattered, peace to the broken, humility to the proud, comfort to the lonely. I want to read a blog that I was subscribed to. When we got involved in this preaching group, someone, I don't know who, I assume probably Peter Granger, got all our email addresses and obviously signed us all up for this blog. And I thought it was pretty random at the start. But I've read and benefited from it. Every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock it pops into my email inbox. And over the years I've been hugely blessed by many of the blogs. So whoever it was that signed us up, I'm very grateful. But this one, I read a few Saturdays ago as I was preparing and thinking of what to say. And if I may, I'd like to share it. I'd like to read it to us this morning, this afternoon, as I obviously feel it's relevant to the sermon. Starts, Hebrews 12:1 urges us, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." If we want to be all out for God and run this race with him, we need to trust him enough to let go of the things that we've held on to for a very long time. Whatever that may be, whether it may be a relationship, a sin issue, a heart's desire, or a vow you made to yourself, what holds us back from a life of all-out service and surrender to God is a lack of trust in God. God is undeniably and undoubtedly the most trustworthy being that this world, or any other world for that matter, will know. Psalm 62:8 declares, "Trust in him at all times. O people, pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us." So why is it that sometimes we find it difficult to trust in God? It's not so much that we don't trust in God, but that we think we cannot trust in him more than we trust ourselves. The one problem that holds us back from all out worship is our own trust in ourselves. We tend to think that we know better than God in a certain area of our life. We say, "Lord, I give you everything, except my money, except my ministry, except my career, because I know how to take care of that on my own. And sometimes I know even better than you." This may not sound really nice, but the more you hold on to that one thing, the more you're just going to mess it up. The more you cling on to your finances, the easier it's going to go away. The biggest lie we have ever been told by this world is that there are some areas we don't need Jesus. But the truth is that in all things, we need Jesus now more than ever. That's why it's important to surrender our lives to him and allow him to take control. That's not to say that we become perfect overnight, because that will just lead us to try to earn holiness by our own strength. When in our hearts we put Christ as Lord in every area of our life, surrendering issues and desires as the Holy Spirit surfaces them, we respond in complete devotion and worship. Service comes freely when we surrender freely. See, Mark's narrative shows us clearly that God does not call the finished article to journey alongside him. He approached and called James and John when they were still steeped in arrogance. And neither did Jesus cast them out when their faults came to bear. He lovingly redirected them, set them straight, and modelled humble leadership to them, moulding them as he journeyed with them. Jesus too reached out and lifted Bartimaeus, quite literally, from the side of the road, where he sat desolate and alone. And we read that Bartimaeus journeyed with him. One can reasonably assume Bartimaeus journeyed with him alongside the disciples and all those who'd been travelling with him since the beginning into Jerusalem, to glory, to death on a cross, and victory over the grave and sin. And see, that's the true beauty of the gospel. It doesn't matter if we've been on the road since the beginning or if today might just be that first step. if we've been knocked to the side of the road, or if we're bathed in pride. Jesus would say, I can strip all that aside. I'm in the business of healing. I can reach into your situation today, and today I'm inviting you to journey with me to glory. That was his message then. That's his message now.